From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ian McEwan, the famous British novelist, was accused recently of copying sentences and phrases from Lucilla Andrews' 1977 memoir about her nursing experiences during World War II. Mr. McEwan acknowledged the use of her work but defended it, saying it was simply for research. So is Ian McEwan guilty of plagiarism? What's wrong with copying a few details from someone's autobiography? In an article called The Ecstasy of Influence, a Plagiarism, in the current issue of Harper's Magazine, Jonathan Lethem argues that plagiarism should be allowed and copyright law is an overused arbitrary monopoly. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Lethem back to my show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me again.
So how would you define plagiarism?
Well, what I really wanted to do with the piece was throw the definition into doubt, because it's a word that's brandished so readily, so easily, and yet I think that it is, it's the kind of word, the kind of notion that is actually a cluster of different ideas, all stuck together and then made demonized very easily. But you know, the arts are not a pure realm. They're not a realm of science where things can be measured by percentages or isolated. Artwork isn't created in a kind of vacuum. In fact, the activity of making art is impure, and it involves drawing on sources and influences at every point.
Well, as we see in other arts, for example, Rauschenberg using a Rubens image, and although there's a big debate in the music industry about sampling and things like that, but aren't there certain distinctions to be made from art and, let's say, historians? If a historian does an unacknowledged borrowing of someone's research or does some unattributed quotes of unique sentences and phrases, shouldn't we call that plagiarism?
Well, I don't have any doubt that there, in academic contexts, in journalistic contexts, there are ethical lapses. There are things that anyone can recognize are violations of good form. What concerns me and what interests me, because that's so unmistakable that I don't find it that compelling, are these applications of what seem like very small principles, lapse of good judgment or of ethics or misrepresentation, which anyone can recognize, it laps into this, or it lapses, I should say, into this.
I was wondering about that lap.
Realm where the practice of artists becomes questioned, as though it should be some kind of pure and immaculate or scientific act of originality, when it's never that. Everyone works by appropriation and pastiche and response and illusion helplessly. It can't be done any other way.
And you give examples of borrowed work and themes, both conscious and unconscious, by many authors and artists. Something called cryptomnesia. What's cryptomnesia?
Oh, well, this is the great, it's a neurological description of the act of forgetting that you learned something and then reproducing it as if it's your own original utterance. And there are lots of examples of artists feeling that they've originated something absolutely in earnest and then having it demonstrated that they, in fact, noticed a source, that there was something put in front of them at some point that they incorporated into their work. This also happens in everyday conversation. We all engage in this act when we make anecdotes and when we offer descriptions of things we see in the world.
Oh, if we have an insight and then discover later that we read that years ago in somebody's book. But there are real borrowings. We had that teenager who did a serious borrowing. Maybe that was going too far. Ian McEwan taking little phrases as research, well, he's in good company. T.S. Eliot was accused of plagiarism from Shakespeare, from The Golden Bough, even to an otherwise unknown writer named Madison Cawein. And he defended himself,
well,
didn't he?
I'll tell you, the thing that interests me most in, for instance, the teenager from Harvard and Ian McEwan, the only thing that I actually find really compelling about those stories as big cultural stories is the comfort with which the accusers reside on their assumptions, the righteousness of the accusation, the certainty that they understand what's gone on and that it's unmistakably something to be condemned is disturbing to me, because in fact the intricacies of those acts and the extremely specific ethical or aesthetic issues that are aroused by them can only be described by analyzing the exact circumstances. I mean, I think for me, the McEwan accusation is absolutely absurd. I mean, it's preempted, obviously, by the fact that he'd been mentioning her name and you know, offered this as an acknowledged source. So it really shouldn't have ever been a story. But the more striking thing to me is the fact that if those kinds of methods, those kinds of impulses, those kinds of behaviors aren't recognized at some point by the audience, by the journalistic community, in fact, by the community of artists, because it's often artists who accuse one another of this act, as actually part of the innate methodology of creating something. Everyone appropriates, everyone alludes, and almost everyone, in a sense, acts in the same way that plagiarists act. But plagiarism is somehow this word that people brandish with confidence. In fact, I think it's an accusation more akin to heresy. What does it mean when someone says, you're a heretic, or sedition? You know, it's a kind of a word that conceals a fudging together of enormous numbers of different badly defined things. The only thing that's clearly articulated is the outrage.
Well, at the end of your piece, you offer a key to readers of every line that you say you stole, warped, and cobbled together, including how you got the title for the piece in Harper's. So you're obviously making the point that this is not plagiarism, but I was wondering how you even went about locating three pages of thoughts and ideas that you've borrowed from others. At times, you must have been confused. Was that my idea?
Oh, I got confused every time I looked at the piece. I'm still confused now because I altered so many people's sentences that they begin to be partly mine. And of course, in this, I was reproducing in a super conscious way, what I think people do all the time, which is half plagiarizing, taking things in and then altering them so that they become, well, for one thing, they move beyond any accusation, but they also become something other. They're no longer your sentences or motifs or images, but they also no longer belong to the other person. Where they belong is in the common realm.
And well, this is what we begin doing this when we write high school papers.
Absolutely,
I think.
Everyone does it, and if you look at, I mean, the stories of even some of the most apparently singular literary voices, for instance. If you look at Hemingway, well, in fact, his first book was a batch of Sherwood Anderson pastiches. You know, who's the most singular voice we can think of? Might it be, Beckett? Well, Beckett began doing Joycean imitations in his early work.
Shakespeare borrowed stuff.
Everyone learns. Well, of course, Shakespeare's work is a total composite. I mean, if you began to disentwine Shakespeare's borrowings, but this is true, of course, of so many things that we see as somehow exalted and so beyond any accusation. So really what we mean when we throw the word plagiarism around is somehow we think this person should be cast out. and should be isolated from this other great activity, which is something we can approve.
My guest is Jonathan Lethem, whose article, The Ecstasy of Influence of Plagiarism, is in the current issue of Harper's Magazine, the February 2007 issue. Well, the real problem is that there are legal aspects to all of this. There are copyright laws, and those copyright laws, if applied, can lead to accusations of plagiarism.
I agree, but one of the very interesting distinctions that you've just alluded to is that there is no legal definition of plagiarism. There's no crime called plagiarism. You can't be jailed for plagiarism. Copyright violation, which is really a completely different framework, very rarely is of any use either as a accusation or as a defense for the people who've been accused of plagiarism.
Well, for example, George Harrison was accused of stealing a song. And if you listen to the two songs, his My Sweet Lord and I think it's He's So Fine or something like that, they do sound very, very similar. Now, maybe he did it unconsciously, as he said, but doesn't the person who did the original material have some rights there?
I absolutely understand that those are the same song, but Leonard, couldn't you and I sit together and come up with 100 other examples of pop songs that are identical? Right now, what happened to George Harrison is that someone went to court and got some money from him. But the kind of activity that he was participating in his case, apparently unconsciously, is so natural, so basic to the act of making music. I mean, I think music is the realm where these certainties become the most absurd, because we can endlessly look at how both the classical and the folk traditions are their body, their very center of that activity is quotation and reinterpretation and appropriation.
As long as it's in the public domain, it's okay.
What we're really talking about is a very recent imposition of a legal framework where something can be owned that previously couldn't be owned. So if we want to talk about art and culture and ethics and right and wrong, we should really talk about the things that precede these legal definitions, because certainly the activity of art making, of culture making, of music making long precedes the very particular copyright laws that we deal with today.
As we see in jazz, where about half of the tunes written during a 30-year span were based on the chord changes of I Got Rhythm and a few other songs, and they all had different names and different melodies, but George Gershwin did give them the original chord changes. But we were talking about artists, and I'm not sure I understood whether you were making a distinction. When Stephen Ambrose is accused of plagiarism, or Doris Goodwin, when they're writing nonfiction books and they take whole paragraphs from somebody else and don't bother to really change them very much, is that plagiarism in your mind?
Well, what I'd prefer to do in this conversation is say the word plagiarism is so problematized, the way it's thrown around, that it doesn't mean enough. What I'd rather say is, from what I understand of some of the cases that you're talking about, and I haven't particularly familiarized myself, when their colleagues looked at the work in question, they had ethical quandaries. They felt that the work was no longer admirable. Now, you can look at any given case and decide whether or not the appropriation or the plagiarism, if you want to use that word, has a kind of an ethical basis that's acceptable to you. But I want to try to – what I'm trying to do in my provocation with that word is say, you know, if Ian McEwan's a plagiarist, I certainly am. And you know what? If Shakespeare was working today, he'd be helpless to those accusations. He'd be absolutely beset with them.
You point out, you accuse the Walt Disney Company of hypocrisy in this area.
Well, there's a term I tried to introduce in my piece called disnial. And disnial is when you take something out of the common realm, when you use something that was never copyrighted or whose copyright has lapsed, and you completely appropriate it, as, for instance, the Disney Corporation did with Pinocchio or Alice in Wonderland. And then you subsequently put a very strong cap on other people's use of the cultural materials that you yourself captured by copywriting them, but did not belong to you to begin with. In other words, influence flows in, but it doesn't flow out. That's denial.
Well, under those circumstances, we're going to see in the application of Jonathan Lethem's approach to plagiarism, McEverything's soon, because McDonald's has been clamping down on the use of Mick in any restaurant that hopes to serve fast food.
Right. Well, we all have a kind of intuitive response to that brand of hypocrisy. I mean, my favorite instance is the word Band-Aid. I grew up with this word as a word that was as familiar to me as, you know, taxi cab or toothbrush. It was an object name. And that was because of the genius of the marketing that had established this word in the consciousness of people of my generation. That was the name for that object. You can't ask everyone to take something into their minds, into their world, into their cultural vocabulary, and then restrict their use of it. There's a certain penalty that's a natural one that you pay for a level of success. You can't write Gone with the Wind and have it become part of the American cultural vocabulary and then say, no, you can't refer to it. You can't parody it. You can't play with it. You can't touch it or taste it. These things are part of our environment now.
What was your reaction to the article on the front page of the New York Times this week about the Levi Strauss Denim Company's famous V-shaped stitching on the back pocket being imitated by other denim companies and Levi's suing for copyright infringement?
Well, you know, one of the great quotes I didn't manage to incorporate into this piece was a fashion designer who said it's laughable to patent the seasonal arts. And I thought that was such a beautiful phrase because pretty much anyone who looks into this realm of patent law, copyright law, trademarking, knows that the present era is one where basically, corporate interests have extended the reach of these notions into unimaginable new realms, and also expanded the duration of copyright and the duration of patents. And there's no precedent in human culture for so much that would ordinarily be seen as common coin, the language of culture, images and notions and materials that anyone could adapt or play with, being captured and owned by private interests.
Jonathan Lethem's article, The Ecstasy of Influence, of Plagiarism, is in the current issue of Harper Magazine, the February 2007 issue. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks
again.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.